Hey, everybody. We have done a cell phone episode of the podcast before. This is our first Skype episode. Coincidentally, our first pantsless episode, or at least for me. I have one of my best friends, my best man, Matt Sachs, on Skype with me. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Of course. We've been waiting more than 2.5 years for you to come on the damn show, but you're in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
Yeah. You sound so happy about it.
I'm in it's actually an underrated, really great city. Like, people don't know about it on the coast.
Sure.
A lot.
Sure.
But this is a really cool place.
Yeah.
With like a great theater and comedy scene.
Right.
And art scene, museums, music. The Replacements are from here, you know.
Oh yeah, right.
Soul Asylum, Prince.
My favorite comedian.
It's got incredible restaurant scene with chefs that have won like James Beard Awards. It's got the best parks in the country according to like 3 magazines. This is a really cool place. If it weren't like a frozen tundra for like 5 months of the year,
yeah,
everyone would live here.
I'm excited to come out whenever that ends up happening. We are going to do a live episode there.
Yeah, it'll be fantastic. And it really is. This is really like a great place, to be very honest. It's a really great place. I ended up here not of my own choosing.
Sure.
And to be honest, I lucked out.
Matt, it's for everybody really who doesn't know, is in the Witness Protection Program, should probably not be using his real name. I don't know why do you want to pick another name for the rest of the podcast or
I will pick Oscar Achimgirdis as my
I don't get the reference, but I'm sure it's very funny.
Yeah, it's funny to people who know a certain DJ around the country.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. So what we picked...
We'll just say I'm Kaiser Sose.
Okay, that's fine. Kaiser Sose works. So we picked... I was about to hold up the album as though people could see it, but you can look at it. Here, you don't have the vinyl of it. I have it. It's great. We picked Of Thee I Sing, which is a Gershwin musical... But we picked it for a very specific reason. Matt and I, when was it? 2006. Matt and I sort of co-developed this documentary idea, this comedy documentary about the vice presidency. And we've been working on it since. We also have like a sister podcast to this that we've only done 2 episodes for. So it's, we're busy people. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
But it's a very funny office. And this... Maybe this album isn't the best example of why. It's not maybe their best work.
No, well, this is what's interesting. It's probably not the Gershwin's best work by far.
Right.
But it won the Pulitzer Prize.
That is true.
This won the Pulitzer Prize for, like, its writing, which means that Ira won a Pulitzer, but George did not, because the music doesn't count for the Pulitzer. It's the writing that counts for it.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So Ira won the Pulitzer. George did not, and then they awarded him one posthumously for it on his like 100th what would have been his 100th birthday.
That's interesting. So that's like almost a dagger in the back. It's like, yeah, we'll wait till you die. Here's your honorary Pulitzer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that I don't know if even it was honorary. It was like just like posthumous.
Okay. But, right.
But it won the Pulitzer Prize in 1932, I believe.
Right.
1932. It was the first musical to win the Pulitzer Prize for drama.
That's pretty great. That's pretty great. I mean, you know, it's just, I guess it's possibly, I guess the reason is it's sort of, I would at least characterize it as the least catchy, not all of it, but a lot, on a whole, it's the least catchy of their stuff.
It's very uncatchy.
Yeah.
There's no, like, when you think of, like, show tunes and Gershwin, you think of something that sticks in your head.
Sure.
And you'll remember it.
Mm-hmm.
This has nothing like that whatsoever.
No. I mean, it's funny that a show that's about politics, you know, old-timey politics, which is, you know, it's still kind of... Most of those things hold true, because politics are politics are politics. Usually it's about smooth talkers, and this... None of this is smooth flowing. These are just, like, the most... Maybe that's intentional. I don't know.
It's... I think you might be right. I mean, part of it is the sincerity of, like, the whole Wintergreen and his love campaign. That's what he campaigns on, the guy who becomes president in the musical. He campaigns on love.
Pretty forward-thinking, you know?
Yeah. And they don't show how he wins. He just wins. Convenient.
Right, 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 right. And then...
no talk running against or anything.
And then, coincidentally, the way he gets his wife is through basically a beauty contest. And which is... what's great is, you know, I've talked about this on the show before, but my feature film, Looking Forward, in which Matt co-stars, the way my character, future president Jason Klom, finds his wife through a reality show, sort of a beauty contest, the modern day beauty contest.
Although, yeah, and when we came up with that idea, we thought it was so original and it fit like this whole, you know, modern era of reality shows and how shameless they are and what crap they are, like The Bachelor and all that. How to, like, I Want to Marry a Millionaire, all that horrible crap. And then, in 1932, the Gershwins decided, how can we find our presidential character a first lady? Oh, we'll have a beauty pageant.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess arguably you and I are as smart as the Gershwins. Is that what we're saying? We deserve a Pulitzer.
I guess we could put it that way.
Yeah.
I could definitely put it that way. Of course, in the musical, the woman who wins a beauty pageant does not get to be first lady, though.
That is true.
That's an incredibly important plot point. Maybe the only important plot point.
Yep, that could be it. There are entire songs about corn muffins in this show. That'll give you an idea of what
I was about to get into that. Yeah. Like, let's start at the top, though.
Yeah.
At the top of the show, we hear this amazingly loud overture. It's very operatic, and it's just Wintergreen for president. That's the presidential candidate, Wintergreen. Just over and over and over again. John, you know, they say it, they repeat it. And then the first lyric you hear is the one that just nearly made me stand up and walk around the room. It was, he's the man the people choose, loves the Irish and the Jews. Those are the first lyrics you hear outside
great.
Of Wintergreen. For president. And I remember going, I just was like, oh my god!
It is a little shocking for the time, I guess, but appropriate. I think it's, you know.
Shocking for now? Then no one gave a... No one cared.
You think? Nobody gave a shit?
I don't think they did, because you know what? It's something I read in Jack Benny's book, where he talked about, like, you know, ethnic comedy and ethnic comedians. You know, it wasn't everyone laughed at these jokes. Irish jokes, Jewish jokes. It wasn't considered offensive. It was just part of the culture of America that you laughed at different cultures and everyone accepted it. And it was when the melting pot was more the idea of the philosophy of America than the today's salad bowl philosophy.
Right. Do you think that's more what it was and less commentary? It feels like it's a little commentary, if only because it's, you know, he appeals to everybody without trying. I don't know.
Right, I think it's both. I think they're saying, like, you know, here's this character, he loves everyone and everyone loves him because he's campaigning on love.
Sure.
So he's like, by saying he loves the Irish and the Jews, he's saying he loves the minorities and they love him. Because in those days, still Irish and Jews were minorities.
Mm-hmm.
And there still had been no Catholic in the White House. There has been no Jewish person in the White House.
Right.
So, I mean, 4 years before, a guy, an Irish Catholic, had lost an election.
Mm-hmm.
Al Smith had lost the election. And he was an Irish Catholic running against Hoover in 1928, in the last presidential election.
Right.
So I think that's sort of what they were trying to address in that moment.
And specifically, there's a character in this. I think the reason we even learned about this is from, there's a guy who helped us out with our documentary by interviewing for it. His name's Steve Talley. Wonderful guy. His book, Bland Ambition, which is kind of like the book we both first read and really got into the vice presidency with.
I mean, it's the first book, that we read.
Yeah. And he mentions, I think, specifically of the I Sing being based off of the vice president character, and this is called Throttle Bottom, which is...
Yes, Alexander P. Throttle Bottom. Yes.
Now, I'm assuming that really wasn't... Was that an old term that the kids used back in the day? It must be.
I don't know. It sounds like it could come from cars and rumble seats and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
That's what it sounds like to me. I don't know.
But that's... The VP that's based on is a real guy named Charles Curtis, who happens to be one of my favorites, if only because of the insane shit that he did as a vice president.
Yeah. The character is definitely based on Vice President Curtis, who was vice president... At the time of this musical, he was vice president of the United States. And without a doubt, and I know that part of the reason you find him so funny is you said that, you know, he's so ridiculous and the ridiculous stuff that came around his vice presidency and everything.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think he actually had a few good qualities, but I know Steve Talley disagrees with me, but he had a few before whatever happened to him later in life.
And what happened to him was he got elected vice president, and that's when everyone says, all the reporters and everyone says, like, his head just
swelled
50 times bigger, you know? Charles Curtis's head swole up. Like before that, he had been like the Senate majority leader, minority leader, or whatever, and he was fine with people calling him Charlie and stuff.
Right.
And then, like about a week after he was inaugurated as vice president, you know, one of his old Senate buddies, a guy who'd known him for like 26, 30 years, came up and said, "Hey, Charlie." He's like, "What's with that Charlie stuff? Don't you know I'm vice president now?" It's like he was one of his oldest friends.
That's insane. That is insane. There are just so many more stories like that, where this guy who is kind of the original glad-handing, memorize everybody's names politician. I mean, that literally happened. He had an entire county's names memorized for the most part.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah, he's this classic politician, kind of the basis of all the good and the bad you ever hear about politicians. Just kind of, he loses everything that his life was about the second he becomes vice president.
Yeah, it's like the second he became vice president, every good thing that he was about, he kind of threw that out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And all it was from there on was controversy and just flat out stupid things.
Mm-hmm.
Flat out stupid things that he did.
Is there anything in this album that stands out as particularly, that still sort of holds up to you?
There is. There are specific lines that hold up. You know, like, at one point, the reporters ask Wintergreen, after he's been elected president, like, "Now that you've had your 17 vacations." And that always seems to be an issue with reporters and the public. Like, you know, the president's on vacation again.
Yeah.
So even then, they were talking about it. The 17 vacations. That was a line that I was like, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's accurate. That fits even now.
Sure.
Obviously, like, I found, like, the whole beauty pageant thing with our reality show contest and our movie very cognizant and and very, like, you know, like, had great foresight to me.
Sure.
Of them, like, they were realizing, like, already the Gershwins were saying, like, we see this. The thing about it is, it's just, there's nothing that stands out, like, to me, that's all that fantastic. Like, I made notes while I was listening to it just to try and, you know, keep up with it.
Sure.
And in listening to it, a lot of it's the rhymes. You know, what they were trying to do is trying to be like Gilbert and Sullivan in a way.
Mm-hmm.
To make it very rhymey and patter-like.
Right.
And to that end, they made all sorts of ridiculous rhymes. Like, they're clever, but they're ridiculous. And, like, they'll make a rhyme like, I don't even know. I'm trying to think of a specific one when they were listing all the foods, like with the corn muffins.
Yes.
You know, which we'll get to as a key plot point as well. Like, they'll say, some women are good at pies and pies with quinces, others with blintzes, and others with stuffins, and others with muffins. And I'm stuffins and muffins, and I'm like, good Lord.
Yeah, they tried kind of hard. Sorry, what was that last thing you said?
It's just a list of foods they thought that would rhyme.
Yeah. Yep. That's basically it. And I maybe that's why they waited on the Pulitzer for the music. Maybe the text of it is a little stronger. I don't know. I've never seen the show.
Right. I mean, the dialogue might be brilliant. I don't know.
Sure.
But the songs are just ridiculously bad in so many ways. And I mean, they literally say in one song, the point we're making in this song is that we get along.
Right.
They'll go meta a few times and admit, like, we're singing right now.
That's pretty good, you know.
It is. They go meta a few times. Like, you know, like, they flat out say, this committee will say why we're doing this to music. When a Senate committee is having a meeting, like, they start out the song. The guy sings, the first guy who's the head of the committee sings, and now the committee will say why we are doing this vote to music.
That's pretty good. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, you're going to say that you're doing this to music. Okay.
Are there, you know, and the thing is, this is the only thing that I've seen besides once all the shit went down with Watergate of there being this much theater that had a vice president, if not the star of it, just sort of at the center of a dramatic piece. I mean, you know, up until, like I said, Agnew is the only one that I can think of. I could be wrong. Right.
I think you're right. I mean, when you look at the stuff in between this and Watergate, there's nothing really.
Yeah.
I mean, and then we get to this. We get this in Watergate, and this was like, obviously, part of why they wrote this was it was the Depression, and they were trying to pick people up.
Mm-hmm.
And with Hoover and Curtis in the White House, it was easy to poke fun at the president and vice president.
For sure.
And that is why this was such a hit.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a hit in the middle of the Depression, the height of the Depression, 31, 32, 33. This ran for over 400 performances on Broadway. People paid good money to see it.
Mm-hmm.
When there wasn't much money around.
Right. Right. It's crazy.
Because it's crazy. Because it was so, it spoke to them.
Mm-hmm.
It gave them a laugh. You know, this was like the height of radio comedy. You know, the golden age of radio is going on at this time.
Right.
The Depression, but it's the golden age of radio with Jack Benny, Burns and Allen, Fred Allen, you know, amazing stuff on the radio.
Yeah.
And the Gershwins were making shows on Broadway. And this was their show.
Yeah.
And it was a hit, a huge hit. And it's because it satirized politics and it poked fun at the White House. And, you know, until we had the absurdism of Watergate and the ridiculousness of the whole Watergate situation and Spiro Agnew's resignation, which wasn't technically tied to Watergate but happened during it.
Sure.
We didn't have this kind of comedic figure.
Mm-hmm. It's true, and I mean, they're both at these very critical times. I mean, you know, it's you know, we've got the Jazz Age going into the Depression, and then we've got, you know, the hippies going into Watergate. You know, Watergate kind of destroying everybody's innocence. These two kind of big collapses in
America. They are.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, like, this was the height of the Depression when this came out.
Yeah.
I mean, it was getting to be like the peak years of it. Like, the peak years of the Depression were like 32 and 33.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when this came out in 32 and ran until through into 33 with over 400 performances. It spoke to people.
Sure.
It made them laugh.
Yeah.
And God knows they needed it. And, and you know, what you're saying, like that parallel, yeah, I mean, like, Watergate came at the end of the 60s and into the 70s, and this came at the height of the Depression. We were leaving the roaring 20s, the Depression's going on, and it bridged something. Something about it spoke to people.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know that. I don't think it's a coincidence that the vice president has always been, he's an easy friggin' target. You know?
Totally.
No, because nobody knows what he does. Even he doesn't know what he does. That's always the classic joke.
Right, and that's the joke that is in this musical with the vice presidential character Throttlebottom. The joke is that he's a nobody, that nobody recognizes him. That's the running joke through the whole show.
Yeah.
Is that President Throttlebottom, no one knows who he is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to get to the White House after the election, he has to sneak in with the tour group.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, you know, and I've actually got, there are some great, I'll put a link to this on the podcast in case people are somehow interested, but all the Senate biographies of the VPs are really brilliant, and they're not as, you know, funny as Tally stuff, but Tally stuff is more in our sort of wheelhouse. But the Senate bio, which is written by Senator Mark Hatfield, which they're all really good, but it opens with, I'm just going to read it. it says, in the spring of 1932, George and Ira Gershwin's Broadway musical of The I Sing spoofed Washington politics, including a vice president named Alexander Throttlebottom, who could get inside the White House only on public tours. The tour guide, who failed to recognize Throttlebottom at one point, engaged him in a discussion of the vice presidency. The guide says, well, how did he come to be vice president? Throttlebottom says, well, they put a lot of names in a hat, and he lost. The guide says, what does he do all the time? Throttlebottom says, well, he sits in the park and feeds the peanuts to the pigeons and the squirrels, and then he takes walks and goes to the movies. Last week he tried to join the library, but he needed two references, so he couldn't get in.
Right, right. So, he can't get a library card because he doesn't have enough ID to do it.
And that shit sort of still held up until, you know, the Mondale era, and still after that, because Quayle obviously, you know, didn't help anybody. You know,
I mean, until Dan Quayle, we didn't have vice presidents that were... The three vice presidents who were most made fun of in American culture were Curtis, by virtue of this musical, then Spiro Agnew, and then Dan Quayle.
Yep, yep. And maybe beforehand it would have been, on a darker note, Aaron Burr, because he's just more notorious than made fun of, but...
Yeah, I mean, people used him as, like, a dramatic figure to, like, spice up something. They used him as a dark, sinister character.
Right.
Became part of the culture, no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. Part of the culture, he was put into plays and novels and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. He was very useful as a romantic, mysterious, devilish figure.
And oddly enough, Michael Bay gave us the first time he was a punchline, at least in my lifetime that I can remember. Right. He gave us the milk commercial with the peanut butter.
Right.
And I'm sure we're really exciting people with all of our vice president references. So let's let's move off of it for a second, and let's talk about your comedic influences. First of all, like I said, Matt used to live out here in Los Angeles. We used to hang out, used to work at FAO Schwartz together with previous guest Andy Bolt. We would hang out. We ended up doing the vice president thing together, but Matt now does the Minnesota version of A Drinking Game, which is a show I do out here, which, by the way, is now just expanded to New York. So if anybody's in New York, you can go see that soon, hopefully. Headed up by the awesome Lauda Perez. She does great stuff. She's amazing. It's going to be a good show. Either way, Matt's an actor. Matt still writes and does stuff. We're working on a bunch of projects together, sort of, you know, Middle Coast and West Coast. Let's talk about, I know when we do an episode out there, you're going to want to talk about No Cure for Cancer. Is that the first, like, comedy album you listen to, though?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about it, because, like, I'm going back to the vinyl part of the show.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of the first comedic stuff I listened to on vinyl,
mm-hmm.
were the Sesame Street records that my parents bought.
Yes.
Like, they bought me a lot of Sesame Street records, because when I was a little kid, like 4 or 5, I loved Sesame Street.
Mm-hmm.
4 or 5. So they bought, like, tons of these records. Sesame Street at the time came out with tons of records.
Yeah.
Tons. And they were a huge comedic influence on me, these sketches that were on the records,
mm-hmm.
because obviously I couldn't see them.
Right.
Some of them were Sesame Street, but some of them were original sketches made for the records.
Oh, so that's awesome.
They were very audio-centric.
Mm-hmm.
One of them that was very influential on me was like a Bert and Ernie sing-along one, mm-hmm. where Ernie decides to have a sing-along because he hears Bert singing in the bathtub. So what does he do? He invites everyone from Sesame Street, and they all somehow fit in Bert and Ernie's bathtub. There's this whole trail. Everyone somehow squeezes in. There's this whole ridiculous sequence where somehow Ernie shoves the piano into the bathroom. And then following him comes everybody, like, you know, Gordon and Linda come in, and then Bob comes in and is like, oh, the acoustics are great in here, Ernie. It's a real great place for a sing-along. Oh, hi, Bert. And Bert's like, oh, hi, Bob. I'm in the bathtub here. And then, like, everyone keeps coming in. Big Bird comes in. It's just ridiculous.
That's pretty awesome.
And then it ends with the University of Michigan marching band coming into the bathroom, along with some elephants and a whole parade. And in between, they do tons of singing and sing-along songs, and oh my god, it's just one of the most absurdistly funny things I'd ever heard. And I just remember, like, listening to it before I go to bed, just, like, sitting there and lying in bed engrossed in this and thinking, like, this is one of the funniest things I've ever heard. And there were sketches on that. There were sketches that Grover had. I thought the Grover sketches were very funny and clever.
Mm-hmm.
And then more Bert and Ernie sketches. So these are the first, like, records, and I consider them comedy albums because they were funny sketches and comedic sketches that I could... Then I look back on and go, that's really clever, funny writing.
Right, right, right.
Perfectly performed by, you know, the Muppet performers.
Of obviously. Course. No. That's we haven't done a Muppet album yet, and I really, really want to because it's just great. But,
yeah, I had a Muppet Show album as well. Like, I had the Sesame Show, and I had a Muppet Show album, and it, again, had... Great. It had sketches, you know, that were from the actual television show, but they wrote special sketches and special storylines just to work on the record.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't have a guest star on these records, so it had to be just like Kermit and the main Muppet characters carrying the story.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they'd go meta and go like, oh, we're making this album here.
That's pretty good.
And they'll also sound great on the record. So those were very influential as well. When I was a kid.
Sure.
And then, of course, like, you know, Weird Al came out, and that was hugely influential.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to what you said at the top, yeah, I mean, the first comedy album that really kind of made me go, oh my god, that's amazing, was No Cure for Cancer,
mm-hmm.
Dennis. And we'll talk about it, you know, when we do the podcast here. But to just briefly touch on it, yeah, I mean, it blew me away.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I had never heard the whole thing. I'd seen bits and pieces of him doing the promos on MTV, talking about Cindy Crawford and and the bus with R.E.M. and everything like that.
Right.
Famous bit. But I never heard the whole thing from beginning to end. And then I heard it, you know, the whole thing. And I was just shocked. I never heard anything like that.
Yeah.
And I don't mean like I was like, oh, what horrible language. It wasn't like it was like, oh, the language is so bad. It was the darkness of it.
Yeah.
The obsessions with death and grisly death.
Yeah.
And elf death and every kind of death.
Mm-hmm.
Smoking. And the love of these things that were bad for you, like smoking and drinking. Like, I didn't smoke in high school. I didn't drink at all. My football coaches put the fear of God into me about that sort of stuff. They, like, made it clear, like, if they ever saw us smoking or drinking, we were off the team, and,
yeah.
You know, they put the fear of... It wasn't... No, none of that Nancy Reagan say no to drug stuff made any difference to me whatsoever.
Right.
It was my... I didn't even care about drugs or alcohol at all. I was scared of them because my football coaches scared me.
Right. Right.
My parents never sat me down to talk with me about it or, like, did anything like that. You know, they trusted that I was a smart kid and wouldn't do that stuff, and I never did.
Sure.
But my football coaches scared me about it. But here's, like, year after I'm finished with high school, I'm listening to Dennis Leary talk about how wonderful smoking and drinking are. And I'm like, wow, I thought those things were horrible.
On that early stuff, so you did actually have vinyl albums. Did your parents have any comedy albums sitting around?
I think they had. They definitely had George Carlin's Class Clown.
Of course.
That was the first, like, comedy album I saw in there. They had a lot of albums, you know, like, they were, you know, baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was something of a little bit of a hippie.
Mm-hmm.
Not my dad at all, but But they had a lot. But they were both, you know, liberal Democrats, and they listened to, like, they had a lot of rock albums. But comedy albums, they had a Bette Midler one, like Divine Miss M.
Uh huh.
And they had Class Clown.
Okay.
They had Class Clown for sure.
Would they let you listen to that?
No. No. They did not. But I know they had it, and yeah. I know, like, they admired it a lot. It was like, I can't remember, like, those are the two comedy albums I remember them definitely owning, those. And they bought me, they didn't hesitate to buy me all those Sesame Street and Muppet Show albums, and tape of, you know, and audio cassettes when cassettes came more popular, of Weird Al and everything. So those were, but so I didn't really listen to many comedy albums, unless you count those Sesame Street ones, that it wasn't until I listened to No Cure for Cancer that I realized, oh, a comedian can have an album.
Right.
They're not playing lots of songs, where they're just standing in front of an audience recording, you know, a concert.
Yeah.
Like, I had not seen Eddie Murphy's Raw or anything like that. So, like, No Cure for Cancer was really, like, I went out and bought it. Like, I bought it on a cassette to listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
And listen to it over and over again.
Do you, being out in Minneapolis, do you get to go see much comedy, or is it mostly theater?
I see. I mean, there's good comedians come here a lot. Like, I saw Nick Thune here at Acme, which is a great comedy club here. Acme's a great comedy club here. Like, I think it's where Louis Black recorded his latest album.
Oh, nice.
The Acme Comedy Theater here. So comedians come here. Lots of great comedians come here. To answer that question, like, the only, like, I've been to a few stand-up shows, like Nick Thune, mm-hmm. and then I went to, when Dennis Leary came to town, I went to see the Rescue Me tour with him, Lenny Clark, and Whitney Cummings.
Uh-huh.
And that was at the State Theater, the big theater, in the heart of downtown Minneapolis, and I saw all three of them, and they were fantastic.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of my friends. I mostly see theater and improv. Like, I'm in an improv group, and I perform improv regularly, and I'll go and see improv regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen some stand-up shows here. Stand-up has never been something, like, I've gone out and see.
Yeah.
And gone to see. I guess I got burned out on it because of the big boom of it in the 80s, you know, with comic standing in front of the brick wall and everything like that. I guess kind of, like, it was on all the time. It was just so saturated on VH1 and everything like that. I was like, ugh, not stand up again.
When you're in LA, same thing?
Same thing. You know, in LA, I lucked into seeing Patton Oswalt live.
Oh.
Which was amazing because it was at the Borders Books on La Cienega.
Oh, nice.
I was just hanging out there, and they put a mic next to the little cafe area, and they were like, okay, so we're going to have some comedians. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, time for me to go. and then they said, but we're going to have Patton Oswalt. Now, this was like in about 2000, I want to say 2002, 2003.
Mm-hmm.
He hadn't exploded yet.
No, no, no.
He was nothing near where he is now.
He hadn't talked about Diane Keaton and apples juice and a jacuzzi yet.
No, he hadn't done any of the stuff that's on Werewolves and Lollipops or all that kind of stuff, which is now my favorite comedy album, probably. One of my favorite all-time comedy albums as well, with No Cure for Cancer. But it was before all that. He hadn't exploded yet. Like, he'd had a special on HBO or something. He toured a little bit. He was somebody who was, like, still very, you had to be in the know to know who he was. Like,
sure.
He was performing at Largo on Fairfax a lot still. He'd moved to L.A., he was living in L.A., but he wasn't a big, huge comedian yet. He was definitely nowhere near what he is now.
Yeah.
Where he's a very prominent cultural comic. He was just like, he was well-known in comedy circles and to people who'd seen him, but not to, like, the general public. So I was like, oh my God, Patton Oswalt.
Ladies and gentlemen, in this final rally of the campaign, I give you John P. Whittingham, our charge.
My friends, I beg you to bear with me for a moment while I ask the girl of my dreams if she will become my heart's delight. Mary, if I'm elected president, will you marry me?
If you're elected president, I will.
Citizens, it's up to you.
Sing them the campaign song, Jack.
Of thee I sing, baby. Summer, autumn, winter, spring, baby. silver lining. You're my sky of blue. There's a love light shining just because of you.
So like I ran over to see it, and sure enough, he's like set, and he did say, I remember he said, let me put this mic to Hobbit height. And then years later, I heard him use that on an album, and I'm like, I saw him do that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I stood next to, what was interesting was, I stood next to Brian Posehn while he did his set.
Mm-hmm.
So Posehn was there, and as everyone knows, like, Brian Posehn is like, I don't know, 6'7" or
massive,
something like that.
Massive, yes.
Massively big. He's like 6'7", 6'8". And he was on Just Shoot Me at the time.
Oh, right.
So, yeah, so, like, he was almost better known than Patton.
Mm-hmm.
I think Patton might have been on King of Queens at that point. I don't know.
I think so.
I never watched that show.
Me neither.
But
he guested on News Radio once, I know that.
Right. Posehn had been on News Radio as well.
Yeah, he played two different characters.
Right. But he was best known as being that weird male guy on Shoot Me.
I remember that.
And so I was sitting next to Posehn, and Patton basically did a test set. Basically what he did was, he had his cards, and he's literally reading from the card.
Awesome.
He'd read jokes, and if they went well, he'd like make a little note. He'd whip out a pencil and make a little note on it, and if it didn't work, he'd just toss it. He'd literally like, flip
holy
it away.
Shit. You know how much one of those would be worth to somebody right now?
You know, he literally did that. He did like about 15, 20 minutes of this material. It was a chance for him to test material, and there were only like about a dozen of us standing there.
That's crazy.
It was really amazing. And after he was done, like I went up and like I talked with Posehn during the set, and I told him I really liked the set I'd seen him do on television.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, after the set was over, like I talked with Posehn and Patton for like a few minutes about like, wow, I just can't believe I got to see you do this. And he's like, yeah, this is what I do sometimes. I just like, they give me a mic, I'll do some jokes, you know?
Yeah.
Like random people, you know, I'll see how they work. And I was like, wow, I never would have guessed that you'd do this.
That's
it was
awesome.
Very enlightening and an awesome thing. I felt like I was in a small private show.
Sure.
And so what if he was testing material? You know, I remember like later I heard some of those jokes, him using them.
Sure.
At the show I saw him in. So I was like, wow, I saw him use that joke for the first time.
It's pretty good.
It was a really cool experience. So I didn't go seek, and so in LA even, I didn't go seeking stand-up. I was working to try and do a theater and film and TV. Stand-up was something, I don't want to do it personally. I find it kind of terrifying to just be myself in front of an audience. I'm more comfortable playing characters. And But, so it's not something I sought out, but these comics, so those albums, listening to those Sesame Street albums, I still find them very funny. When I like find old bits on YouTube or whatever, I love listening to them. And then there was a big gap, but then I listened, like I got to, I realized, oh, George Carlin's a genius. I better go listen to these concerts of his.
Yeah. Room
for Myself and Class Clown. So I went out and found them, and I listened to them and No Cure for Cancer, and Werewolves and Lollipops, and Weird Al albums, and those things were influential. But when I think of what influences me and the kind of comedy I want to do and perform, it's hard to put a thing on it, but like Kevin Smith is obviously a huge influence.
Sure, your daughter's named after a character in one of his movies.
So Kevin Smith's a big influence because, again, like I never heard anything like that.
Yeah.
Like, when I saw Clerks for the first time after my freshman year of college, like the summer after my freshman year of college, before my sophomore year of college, I never heard anyone, characters, talk about that sort of stuff. Like, I'd forgotten about Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Forgotten about Star Wars. It was not part of something that I thought about all the time. It had sort of disappeared.
Did he brought your nerdness back to you, or at least that part of it?
He brought Star Wars back for me, for sure.
Yeah.
And, like, people were talking about comic books and stuff and about women in a way that I and people who I knew talked about it. It seemed very real. It seemed very real and natural. I look back now, I go, you know, separated from it, I go, oh, that's kind of unnatural.
Sure.
You know, not just like how people talk. But then, as a 19-year-old kid, it blew me away.
No, I bet.
It blew me away, and it was hugely influential. And I wanted to be able to, like, talk that graphically about sex and mix in sci-fi references with it and everything. And there were terms in it that I never knew. Like, I didn't know what a jizz mopper was. And I'd never heard of hermaphroditic porn. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff in that movie. Like, I was like, I never heard of this stuff.
He was strangely ahead of his time in a way that no one maybe should be.
It might be. But the Star Wars, the whole Death Star conversation of, like, Empire, which did you like better, Jedi or Empire?
Oh, right.
Empire, blasphemy. That whole sequence just made me go, I haven't thought about Star Wars in, like, 13 years.
Yeah.
You know, I hadn't thought of Star Wars since, like, Return of the Jedi came out when I was, like, 7.
Yeah.
So it had been, like, over a decade since I'd really thought about Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole conversation in that movie made me go, Jesus, whatever happened to Star Wars?
Did you... Okay, so let's... You grew up in St. Louis.
Yeah.
Is there a scene of any kind there now? Was there then?
Well, growing up, I was completely unaware of anything, if there was.
Yeah.
You know? I lived in the suburbs. I would go to the city for ball games and for field trips. It wasn't like... I wasn't that kind of kid who, like, you read about, like, how Jim Morrison would go strike out and walk through, like, horrible parts of towns that he lived in, like, in Norfolk, Virginia, or wherever he grew up. I was very kind of isolated.
Okay.
Like, in that sense. Like, I would go downtown for just with my family for sporting events and for, you know, to go to a restaurant or something, or, like, to the theater.
Mm-hmm.
Or the zoo or something. Like, I wouldn't go... I never really struck out on my own. If there was a scene, I wasn't familiar with it.
Sure.
Now, there was, like, a part of town that I would go... When I became a teenager, I'd go on my own to, called the U City Loop, where we have, like, the St. Louis Walk of Fame, and it's got a restaurant bar there, Blueberry Hill, where Chuck Berry to this day still plays there.
What?
Like, twice, something like that, yeah.
Oh, my God.
It's a very famous place, because Chuck Berry still plays, like, once or twice a month there.
It's amazing.
And has for, like... over a decade, or over 20 years, or something like that.
It's crazy.
You can go see Chuck Berry live in person.
We need to take a trip to St. Louis. That'd be amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's a... I'm not saying, like, it's not a... I had a really happy childhood, and I grew up in a pretty cool town, but I didn't know about, like, anything cool going on.
Yeah.
Like, keep in mind, though, this was pre-internet.
Sure.
Like, you had to strike out and find things on your own. Like, I had to, like... I've told kids at the comic book store that I go to now, if I wanted to find comic books, I had to go through the Yellow Pages.
Right.
Find the store.
Mm-hmm.
Figure out how to drive there myself, because I didn't want to ask my dad to give me directions. There was no MapQuest, no computer to find it.
Sure.
I had to call the store and go, where are you at? Where are you at? Like, I'm coming from here. How would I get there? I'd be on the phone with, like, a guy at the comic book store for, like, 10 or 15 minutes. Then I would ask my dad, hey, I'm going to, like, this part of town. Can you tell me, like, write me some directions a little bit? And he'd look at me a little suspiciously, but he'd write them down and say, okay. And I couldn't do that till I was 16 years old anyway,
because
I needed my driver's license.
Yeah.
Then I'd go to the comic book store, and I'd find my way there. It would take me, like, I'd get lost a couple times on my way there, but eventually I'd find my way there. I had to go out and find cool things.
It's sort
cool
of...
things coming to me from the computer or anything. I had to go out and seek stuff.
It's interesting, like, the way people, there might be some nerds out there who would be like, how could you forget about Star Wars? But there is a whole thing where, like, you make a strong point where to obsess, you had to have access to the thing you were obsessing over. So,
yeah.
You know, unless it was constantly in your life, you would forget about it. It doesn't matter how ubiquitous it might seem now, because the internet gives us access to everything. I'm sorry, this is sounding like the Nerdist podcast. I love that podcast, but they talk about the same kind of stuff all the time. You had to seek it out. You had to make a concerted effort. We're sounding like so fucking old to millennials who are listening to this, you realize
that. I'm sure, but that's how I come off to these kids. Like, when I go to my comic book store now, which is here in Minneapolis where I live, the comic book store I go to is around the corner, literally, from me. Like, it's in a little strip mall around the corner from my apartment, like, 2 minutes away.
Is it a good shop? Is it a good shop? Do you want to plug it?
I'll plug it, yeah. Hot Comics and Collectibles, the New Hope store. They also have a store in Richfield. But I go to the New Hope store, and it is a great comic book store. It's as good as anything in L.A. It's as good as any of the stores I went to in L.A.
Nice.
And they treat me really great there, and it's a great culture there and everything. And they have tons of great stuff. And so, big shout out to them. It's a great store. It's my store here that I go to. When I go there, and I've had these conversations with kids there, kids who are working behind the counter and kids who are picking up their books and everything, and they're bitching about the internet and, like, you know, spoilers for comic books, and they're talking about stuff. I at one point, like, finally, I had to go, okay, you guys don't get it. When I was a kid, I had to ride my bike to the 7-Eleven, to the comic rack, and pay 75 cents for the book. And then I had to, you know, stick it in my pocket or put it in the back of my bike, in the bag that I had attached to my bike. Because you were a boy, you didn't have a stupid girly basket in front of your bike. You had like the equivalent of a bike fanny pack, the back of it.
Right.
And I had to stick my comic book in there and ride home. And that's how I got comics. Like, if I went to 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
You know, if my dad would take me to 7-Eleven after a basketball game or a baseball game and buy me a Slurpee, maybe if I played well, I could get a comic out of it.
That's pretty good.
They were 75 cents. Now they're $3.
Jesus Christ.
When I was growing up, they were 75 cents.
Oh, my God. I haven't bought a comic in probably 15 years, so
if I missed an issue, I missed it.
Yeah.
See, that's why when I became a teenager and got my driver's license, I would go to comic book stores, because I'd be like, I missed that issue of West Coast Avengers back in 1987, 88. And now I have my driver's license, and I want to know what the hell happened in that issue. So I'd go to the comic book store, and I'd go to the racks of old books, and I'd find that issue. And to me, it felt like, you know, like the whole, it felt like the Raiders of the Lost Ark or something like
that. Like, your face melted?
Yeah, almost. I mean, in the joy of it, like, I thought to myself, even then I realized, God, I missed this book when I was away at summer camp. When I was like 10, 11 years old, when I would go away for every summer for like 4 weeks to a summer camp in the Ozarks,
mm-hmm.
It's a book or two, and I'd not know what happened when I got back.
That's crazy.
So by getting back issues, I would be like, I waited 4, 5, 6 years sometimes to find these books and read them.
That's crazy.
You had to hunt them down.
Yeah.
Because there was no internet to go to and order them off of.
Sure.
There weren't comic book t-shirts and superhero t-shirts in every store, you know, in Target or Walmart or whatever. You wanted a comic book t-shirt, you had to, like, photocopy, like, the order form in the actual comic. And then you had to, like, you had 4 or 5 shirts to choose from, maybe. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to photocopy it and write a check, and each shirt was, like, $28.95 or something
Jesus
like that.
Christ.
I didn't order any of them.
Right.
Like, I do this, but I realized, like, this is how I would have to order this shirt. It was ridiculous. You had to make a real effort.
Yeah.
And, of course, if you wore a new superhero t-shirt, you would have gotten the shit kicked out of you.
Right. Right.
Like, I did not talk about reading comics in school. I did not bring comics to school. I never wore a single superhero t-shirt after I was, like, 6 years old until, like, I moved to L.A. and until, like, 2003 or 4. Something like that. I didn't wear a superhero t-shirt.
Yeah.
You know? Superheroes were for dorks, and let's be blunt, I'll say it. Superheroes were for dorks and fags and
sure.
Nerds.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
You'd get the shit kicked out. At least in my high school, you would have gotten the shit kicked out of you if you were wearing something like that.
The senator from Minnesota.
Present.
Check. The senator from North Dakota.
Present.
Check. The senator from Louisiana.
Present.
Check. The senator who's from Montana.
Present.
Check. The senator who's from Nebraska.
Present.
Check. The senator who's from Alaska.
Present.
Check. The senators from other states will have to bide their time. For I simply can't be bothered when the names don't rhyme.
Oh, we simply can't be bothered when the names don't rhyme. The senators from all the states will have to bide their time. For I simply can't be bothered when the names don't rhyme.
The people think they've got taxation.
Ha, ha, ha.
Just wait for further legislation.
Ha, ha, ha.
Today is really full of laughter.
Ho, ho, ho.
Compared to what will follow after.
Ho, ho, ho.
With fury, though, you may be seething.
Ha, ha, ha.
Just wait until we tax your breathing.
Ha, ha, ha.
On taxes, none relaxes when this happy group convenes. Be it payroll, be it income, we are gathered here to sink 'em till there's no one with a nickel in his jeans.
Do you, speaking of things that people might think you're a fag for liking, what about theater? What was like the first theater that you remember being exposed to as a kid?
Oh, God, that's a great question.
Because, I mean, we're talking about a musical, we might as well.
Yeah, I mean, musicals are the first way, like, I was introduced to theater. You know, like, my parents took me to see, like, a musical.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember what the first musical, like, live musical, I'm not going to count, like, Disney movies or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
First live musical I ever saw, I'm honestly kind of blanking on it. I remember, like, being taken to see Yul Brynner in The King and I in the 80s when I was a little kid.
Wow.
Yeah, because he was doing like his final farewell tour or something like
mm-hmm.
that. And I don't know if I appreciated it at the time, obviously, because I'd never seen the movie or anything like that. But now I can at least say, well, I guess I saw Yul Brynner before he died doing The King and I live in person.
Right.
And you'd go to like the big fancy theater in St. Louis. You'd either go to the fancy theater, the Fabulous Fox, or you'd go, and this is a big part of St. Louis culture for over 70 years, the outdoor theater, the Muni, where in the summer you have to pay for certain seats, but there's also the free seating section.
Uh-huh.
And it's a huge, famous outdoor theater where during the summer there's musicals and tons of world-famous people have played there. You know, amazing legends of Broadway have done performances there. I remember seeing Debbie Reynolds do Unsinkable Molly Brown.
That's awesome.
Live there. And also, oh, I'm blank, Carol Channing performed there. I mean, it's a legendary place. Like, you know, you ask people who've toured and they've come to St. Louis and they go, oh, the Muni, God, it's amazing because it's an enormous outdoor theater.
Mm-hmm.
They'll do intimate musicals on the stage. And like when they did South Pacific, they had like World War II planes fly over the theater every night and everything.
That's awesome.
It was awesome. No, it was amazing. So like everyone, like my mom took my kid to see Meet Me in St. Louis there when she visited her one summer.
That's cool.
It's a big tradition. It goes back like generation upon generation upon generation of people go to it. So like those are, any kid who grows up in St. Louis who loves theater, their first introductions to it are usually the Muni and the Fox.
Okay.
And those are big influences. Like seeing Big River at the Muni, that was big. Like because Missourians, it's Big River is a musical based on Huck Finn.
Right, right, right.
Missourians, it's, you know, like, I've read Huck Finn, you know,
mm-hmm.
but my exposure to it was this musical, Big River, and boy, it was amazing.
That's awesome.
I loved it. And we bought the tape, you know, you could buy the tape during, you know, intermission, and we made sure to buy the tape, and we listened to it all the time. And I remember one time, my mom was taking me and other guys to Hebrew school, and she was playing Big River in the car, and I got really embarrassed. Because my friends were all like, what the hell is this? It's the musical we like. I was really, really embarrassed.
Do you know what's the first musical you ever performed in then?
I don't do many. I'm not a singing actor. Like,
sure.
I mostly do plays and improv.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never really been in a big musical.
Okay.
It's something that's not, like, part of my repertoire. Like, the first show I ever did in college, I had to sing songs in it. It was a show called Dark of the Moon,
mm-hmm.
and I had to sing and dance in it. And, ugh, I just hated all the singing and dancing I had to do. I'm not very shy on stage. Like, I've done full frontal nudity on stage
Jesus
before.
Christ.
Yeah, the first play I ever did in L.A. was a full frontal, I had to do a full frontal nudity scene. But nothing makes me more nervous on stage than singing and dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Something I really admire. Like, I'm not very hard on people who are doing it because, you know, I'll see actors criticize people like, oh, they can't sing. Like, they just put these celebrities in these musicals because they're celebrities and they can't sing. I must be tone deaf or something. I don't know. But I admire anyone who's got the guts to go up and sing and dance on a stage because it's nerve-wracking as hell to me.
I think the only way I'd be able to do a nude scene is if it involves singing and dancing. It'd be the only way I'd be comfortable.
Luckily, unfortunately, it didn't, that scene. But in that show as well, I had to do lots of dancing. And I'm good at fight choreography, but I'm terrible at dancing. Choreographed dancing, anyway, for the stage.
So what we normally do at this point in the podcast is I ask the guest, if nobody's ever heard this before, why would you recommend they listen to it? You don't actually have to.
No, that's... You know what? First of all, if you're a Gershwin fan, I think you should listen to it.
Sure.
Because it'll give you an appreciation for how good when they were good. It'll make you go, oh, this is so bad. I really appreciate how great they were.
Right.
And an interesting thing about it is you'll hear snippets of, like, of an American in Paris, or like, you know, good, like great Gershwin stuff. Gershwin used, he cribbed some of his own great stuff.
Sure.
And used just intermittent music in this show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the title of the show is Of Thee I Sing.
Right.
And that song is a song in the show, like, Of Thee I Sing, baby. And they're like, oh my God. But at parts of the show, there are snippets where, like, they revive stuff from An American in Paris and other Gershwin stuff. They crib from themselves.
Right.
It's their attempt to, like, try and write, like I said, like a Gilbert and Sullivan stuff. Oh, yeah, that's right. Like, whenever, like, a big plot point in the show is the French are going to declare war on the United States.
Right.
So whenever the French ambassador comes in, his music is from An American in Paris.
That's awesome. Okay.
So... Yeah. If you want to hear what, like, if the Gershwin's trying to write comedy, and and if you're a historian of, like, musical theater, this is the first musical that won the Pulitzer Prize, so you owe it to yourself to listen to it, at least.
That's true. That is true.
There's no filmed version of it. They did a TV version of it, like, in the 70s with Carol O'Connor.
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
I want to see it.
Yeah, I kind of want to see it, too. They also did a live concert recording of it in 2006 with, of all people, Victor Garber.
Oh, right.
Who I've worked with. I find that amazing.
That's pretty great.
It's pretty great. And Victor Garber is the president of Wintergreen, and an actor named Jefferson Mays, who's more well-known for theater in New York, plays Vice President Throttlebottom in it.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, Mays is also an actor. He played, like, President James Madison in a thing for PBS, like the Dolly Madison. Oh. He played Madison in the Dolly Madison American Experience for PBS.
That's funny.
So he's like a, yeah. So it's interesting. He's a very talented actor. Like, I think Jefferson Mays won the Tony for, or at least got a Tony nomination for I Am My Own Wife. He's mm-hmm. an amazing actor. He's just not very well known outside of New York theater circles.
Right.
So I don't know, if you're a Gershwin fan, you should listen to it. You owe it to yourself to listen to it, because it's George and Ira together. It's a good example of what was considered comedy political satire for its time. And it's just an important piece of musical theater history in the sense, like, it's a Pulitzer winner.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. It's
recognized. That.
And, you know, we'll talk more once we do the episode of our podcast, which I guess I'll talk about now. The documentary is called Vice Presidents, Being Number Two in the White House. Very classy title. That's the name of the podcast, too. It's out there. You'll only see two episodes out there, and they're from a year ago. We are going to pick it up again.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things where... led up to the election, and then after the election happened, it's like, oh, not much to talk about. But of course now, all of a sudden, shit. There's so much to talk about, really.
Please understand, it isn't that I was your Lord Spurner. It's just that there was someone else.
Yes, Mary Tyler.
We're having fits.
We're having fits.
The man admits.
The man admits.
This little sinner
was really winner.
I couldn't see,
his jilting me.
And so I'm doing,
so doing
a bit of suing.
A bit of suing.
She has a claim, it should be called a dirty name.
Yes, if it's true, she has a claim, then you're a dirty, dirty name.
John, no psychoanalyst need tell us. Miss Devereux is simply jealous.
the right. Why should she have the wedding night?
I told you before, she can make corn muffins.
Who cares about corn muffins? All I demand is justice.
Which is more important? Corn muffins or justice? Which is more important? Corn muffins or justice?
Vice President Cheney again had like a hunting thing going on. Like he could kill some antelope at a closed hunt or something like that.
Oh, God.
And Biden had a huge article on GQ written about it.
The Onion released their book, their fake biography of Biden, which I did not pick up yet, but I really want to see that.
Yeah. wow. But to close up on Of Thee I Sing, it's a political satire, and if you listen to it now, you'll go like, oh, how ridiculous. You know, beauty pageant for First Lady, he chooses his girl who's a secretary because she can make corn muffins, which is the dumbest thing in the whole show. The Supreme Court rules that corn muffins are more important than honoring a promise. This show skewers everything. Congress, yeah. Supreme Court, the presidency, the American people. Like, at one point, some character says, like, about Lincoln's famous statement, like, you can fool some of the people some of the time. Oh, it's easier nowadays. People are bigger suckers, or they're more stupid than ever. You know, it had cynicism in it.
Yeah.
It really is a skewering of the entire political system in a way that, like, you know, like Mad Magazine would have done.
Right.
Harmless jokes. And when you read about the history of the show, the actors who played Wintergreen and Throttlebottom were kind of worried that they'd be, like, threatened by the FBI or something. We're doing satire. And you read this script, listen to it, and you're like, they were worried about this crap?
I know.
About joking about corn muffins and the president and France maybe declaring war on America because the president, instead of marrying like the girl who won the beauty pageant, he marries his secretary, and then the girl who won the beauty pageant, it turns out, is in a famous lyric of the show, is the illegitimate daughter of the illegitimate son of the illegitimate nephew of Napoleon.
That's pretty weird.
That's like one of the. That's the ambassador of France in a horrible. By the way, a horrible Pepe Le Pew like French accent. Says she's, you know, she's the illegitimate daughter of the illegitimate son of the illegitimate nephew of Napoleon. And like you're like, what the fuck does that matter? Are you kidding me? And that's why France almost declares war on America in this ridiculous show.
Oh my good God!
We should also emphasize that. Throughout the show, like, Throttlebottom is the butt of all the jokes, and he's the nobody, non-entity.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the show, what happens? Wintergreen resigns
to be with
the girl who he loves, because she's pregnant, and he loves her and everything like that. And Throttlebottom becomes president, and he marries the girl who won the beauty pageant.
Mm-hmm.
He's France, so he wins in the end.
Right. Which is...
winner.
Yeah, traditionally not really the way it actually goes, unless you're very few exceptions, which we could talk about and nerd out about later on. Yeah.
But, like, Throttlebottom, the big butt of all the jokes, you know, the whole show makes fun of him the whole time, he's nothing, he's no one. And then in the end, he becomes president, and he marries the pretty, beautiful southern girl who has her own horrible lyrics as well. No one is spared with horrible lyrics to sing in this show. They're just ridiculous, but... He's the most ridiculous character. He wins. The ridiculous vice president character wins the presidency. He gets the hot woman. He becomes president.
Let's wrap it up with you. What do you have to plug? Shows, Twitter, all that good shit.
Let's plug some stuff right now. This Saturday, October 12th, Shaun of the Dead, a drinking game at the Bryant Lake Bowl, the world-famous Bryant Lake Bowl in Minneapolis and Uptown. As seen on Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, Bryant Lake Bowl, mentioned in GQ Magazine. That's where we hold Drinking Game Minnesota, and this is our show since our hiatus in the summer for the Minnesota Fringe Festival, Shaun of the Dead, a drinking game. My improv group, Last Action Movie, is going to the Toronto Improv Festival.
Nice.
I'm going to be able to go, but I think it's the third year in a row we've been invited to perform at the Toronto Improv Festival. We've performed in Toronto, Atlanta, Spontaneous Combustion Festival. I did get to perform at the Chicago Improv Festival. I went to Chicago with us.
Nice.
We are famous for our 90-minute sets. Sometimes we'll do a 90-minute improvised action movie.
Holy shit.
With Nerf swords and fight choreography. We've taken fight choreography classes, and we incorporate this fight choreography into our sets, and we will do, like, yeah, usually we'll do, like, a 30-minute set or something like that. Mm-hmm. We have done over a half a dozen or more 90-minute sets.
Jesus Christ.
So it's something that we've become known around the country for. And you can watch some of them on our website, lastactionmovie.com. Theater company Shadow Horse Theater is planning a season. I don't want to announce any shows yet, but we're the producers of The Drinking Game Minnesota in association with Embassy Jack there in Los Angeles. We are planning at least a 3-show season, you know, like meaning like a schedule of shows.
Sure.
And we're really focused on nailing down locations, but we're very excited about it. And as always, I like to promote our projects looking forward. Everyone should watch it on YouTube and share it and enjoy it. And Vice President's being number 2 in the White House. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter. You can subscribe to the podcast. You can go to the blog and read the blog stuff.
We're more active on Facebook lately, but we'll get back on the Tumblr thing because it.
We'll try and get back on that. Yeah.
And you're VP Matt Sachs on Twitter.
I am. Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at VP Matt Sachs, and you can follow Vice Presidents on Twitter at Vice Presidents, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can follow Shadow Horse Theater if you do a search for it, you'll find it. Like, it's abbreviated like SHDWHRSETHRE or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you can find our website shadowhorsetheater.com, and you can follow A Drinking Game Minnesota on Facebook. You can follow Shadow Horse Theater on Twitter and Facebook. So we're all over the place, you know, getting out there, promoting the stuff. Lots of good stuff. Lots of good stuff.
I guess just a couple things just to whore out Vice Presidents a little more. We did interview Gore Vidal. We lucked out to interview him a few years ago, and he did say that we were better interviewers than Ken Burns. We got that quote from him.
That you will see that quote at the top of our trailer when you go to the website, vicepresidents.com.
It's really hard to leave that off.
We don't want to leave that off.
Nope.
Also, our Gore Vidal on Aaron Burr clip on YouTube has been viewed over like 14,000 times or something.
Oh,
like
really?
That. Something like that.
That's pretty good. I'll take it.
Yeah, it's a very heavily viewed and commented on clip.
And when we do the podcast, we've talked about the production of it, the production stalling, et cetera, et cetera. But we do have a few stories. The one thing that I really wish we had on camera was Gore Vidal doing his Truman Capote impression, and that is just the one thing I will regret to the day I die.
Yeah, it was amazing.
But we got to see it, so that's pretty damn good.
But we got to see it live in person anyway, yeah. So that's
good. It's pretty great. And he shook my hand.
Yeah, we have pictures. You can see our pictures with him, and we shook his hands, and I got to do some Shakespeare with him and stuff, and it was unbelievable. Pretty unbelievable.
Well,
so there's all these things going on.
This has been awesome, Matt.
Thank you. It was really fun to do it, and I'm really excited about. We'll say this right now. We're planning on Jason to come out here to Minneapolis to show, looking forward, and to do a recording, a live podcast recording. Hopefully, a huge theater, the great improv theater here in town. That would be fantastic. We're hoping to do a podcast here, and I will be attending Wits, hosted by John Moe with special guest Margaret Cho. Next month,
mm-hmm.
Here in Minneapolis for NPR, and that should be pretty awesome too.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Matt, for coming on.
Thank you.
We'll have you on again, and you know, if we can't do the live one soon enough, we'll just do another one by Skype. But
sure.
Guys, thank you so much for listening, and as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Visit StolenDress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books.
Please subscribe on iTunes, rate us highly, and write your reviews. You can follow us on Facebook.com/ComedyOnVinyl and Twitter @ ComedyOnVinyl.